This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Coming up on this week's show, we'll take a look at new Census Bureau data showing a fall in the number of married couples with children. Also, Governor Matt Bevin joins us to talk about the tragic school shooting that occurred in his state of Kentucky last week. But first, the president's first State of the Union address was a highly anticipated event featuring several inspiring guests to tell the story of his first year in office and talking about his plan for hope and prosperity for the nation. Here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins with his thoughts.
President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address Tuesday night before a joint session of Congress. Now, his speech, which lasted a little over an hour and 20 minutes, was one of the longest in the modern era. But I would also argue it was one of the best. The speech was, in my view, a sea change from the previous president in that it celebrated all things American. And I quote from him, quote, "We celebrate our police, our military, and our amazing veterans as heroes who deserve our total and unwavering support," end quote. But what made this speech one of the most remarkable addresses I've heard from the House chamber, and I've heard a number of them, is the way the president wove in powerful accounts of heroism, sacrifice, patriotism, compassion, and commitment. And two such accounts were the actions of Albuquerque Police Chief Ryan Hulitz and North Korean-born Ji Sung-ho. And I'm going to go into more detail with some clips of that in just a moment. But it was an amazing speech. And it began with recounting the natural and man-made tragedies that we've experienced as a nation over the last year. Here's a clip from the first few minutes of the president's speech.
"We have endured floods and fires and storms, but through it all, we have seen the beauty of America's soul and the steel in America's spine. Each test has forged new American heroes to remind us who we are and show us what we can be. We saw the volunteers of the Cajun Navy racing to the rescue with their fishing boats to save people in the aftermath of a totally devastating hurricane."
Now, that sounds like it could be just a throwaway line, the fact that, Americans helping Americans, the Cajun Navy. But let me tell you how significant that was. Yes, it was a shout out to the Cajun Navy. I've had folks in my church that have been a part of that. But let me tell you the difference. Back after Katrina, there were – and that was the devastating hurricane where the levee did not hold and water flooded into New Orleans and people drowned. It was a tragedy. Well, there were those, when the word spread, that grabbed their boats, their pickup trucks and their boats, and they headed to New Orleans to help. And guess what happened? They were turned away. Repeatedly, we've seen the volunteers – no, the government's got this. We don't need your help. Please go away. Get out of here. That's not the case now. Not only did the president affirm volunteerism in times of – but let me tell you the effect that that attitude has had on the federal government. In the – Hurricane Harvey flooded Houston and that part of Texas. There were those, again, there was some from my church that headed over to Houston with their boats. Not only were they not turned away, but they were actually taken into the ranks of the Coast Guard and dispatched to go and rescue people. There was a recognition that the government could not do this alone. And we are so much more powerful when the government sees the American people as a partner in times of crisis. And quite frankly, that's the way it has been in our history, that in times of crisis, we pull together and there's room for everybody to help. And that was one of the powerful messages that was sent last night by the president. But there was more. And this is where the president underscores where our focus is. And I said it a moment ago, these were his words about faith, family, and freedom. Here's the second clip of what the president had to say last night.
Together, we are rediscovering the American way. In America, we know that faith and family, not government and bureaucracy, are the center of American life. The motto is "In God We Trust."
That is historically the American way, not what government can do. But we have, as he said, in America, we know that faith and family, not government and bureaucracy, are the center of the American life. Again, you may take that as some may take it as a throwaway line, but it is a subtle affirmation and statement, bold statement, quite frankly, that we are discovering the American way. This goes back, and I mean, you could dissect this speech so many ways. There's so many layers in it. It was a phenomenally written speech. Let me just put it that way. And I know that the president had teams of people working on it, and I've communicated to some of them because as one who speaks a lot and one who has read many of the greatest speeches in history, this was a speech that was very well done. And in saying this, that we are rediscovering the American way, that's what often is referred to as American exceptionalism. Well, what's at the heart of that? Well, in America, we know that bureaucracy are at the center of the American life. Our motto is "In God We Trust." Again, very powerful statement and affirmation. And then he goes on to talk about some of the important things that they're doing and have done. Here's a clip about the courts. Clip number 3. Let's play that one.
Working with the Senate, we are appointing judges who will interpret the Constitution as written, including a great new Supreme Court justice and more circuit court judges than any new administration of our country. We are totally defending our Second Amendment and have taken historic actions to protect religious liberty.
By the way, he also set a record, I think, in the number of applauses that he received. I like how the Second Amendment and religious liberty were in the same sentence, because it is a fundamental right and they are clearly connected. And it goes back to the courts, what the courts are doing and the fact that he is seeking and putting in place judges who will respect the Constitution. Okay, I want to get to this account later in the speech where he points out that this was by far, well, there's really two, but this is one of the most impactful aspects, not only of this speech, but illustrations that I have seen in a speech, in a State of the Union speech. Let's listen here to clip number 5.
We see a vivid expression of this truth in the story of the Holetz family of New Mexico. Ryan Holetz is 27 years old, an officer with the Albuquerque Police Department. He's here tonight with his wife, Rebecca.
Thank you, Ryan.
Last year, Ryan was on duty when he saw a pregnant, homeless woman preparing to inject heroin. When Ryan told her she was going to harm her unborn child, she began to weep. She told him she didn't know where to turn, but badly wanted a safe home for her baby. In that moment, Ryan said he felt God speak to him. "You will do it, because you can." He heard those words. He took out a picture of his wife and their 4 kids. Then he went home to tell his wife, Rebecca. In an instant, she agreed to adopt. The Hollettes named their new daughter Hope. Ryan and Rebecca, you embody the goodness of our nation. Thank you.
That was one of the most powerful moments of the almost 90-minute speech. And I want you to consider for a moment what the president and his administration communicated with that illustration. Number one, they communicated the sanctity of human life, the value of each and every life, regardless of what zip code it's conceived in or what side of the tracks it might be born on. That was a powerful, powerful pro-life illustration promoting adoption. But there was another one. There's more. This was such a clear illustration of religious freedom. You see, Ryan is a police officer, and on the job, he was prompted by his faith in God to take a compassionate step that led to the adoption of little baby Hope. That's what we're arguing about, the ability to take your faith into the workplace, regardless of what your job might be, so that you might be a person that adds to, contributes to, and is a blessing to society as a whole. Powerful.
If you want to find out more about the work we do here at Family Research Council, head on over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, I want to invite you to be a part of keeping Washington Watch on the air by going to TonyPerkins.com and making a tax-deductible contribution. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with CNS News editor Terry Jeffrey.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. This is because transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. Yet even the federal government has stated that there is no evidence that gender reassignment surgery has improved health outcomes. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. A new U.S. Census Bureau report finds that the number of married couples in the U.S. who have children under 18 hit a 56-year low in 2017. Of all single-parent families in the U.S., single mothers make up the majority. Joining Tony to talk about this new report is the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com, Terry Jeffrey.
Terry, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
All right, before we're going to get into the details of this, but I just want to jump right on top of this from a standpoint of what kind of picture does this present of America's future?
It's a disaster, really. It's a cultural, it's a political, and it's an economic disaster. We've turned into a country where fewer and fewer people are getting married and having kids. You have the baby boom moving into retirement, going on to Social Security and Medicare. What I see happening, Tony, is that the Americans who live the traditional life, who grew up, get married, have kids, stay married, work hard, they are going to be slammed by taxes and big government in order to cover the welfare benefits and the government entitlements for people who don't live that life, to put it very bluntly. And I think that it really is at the heart of the political divide in this country. It is both economic and cultural. The economic and cultural aspects of it are indivisible. Most people don't want to talk about the cultural aspect of it, but I think this disappearance of the traditional family in America is at the very heart of it.
Here's something that's kind of counterintuitive, especially from the standpoint of the political class, that the idea that children, when you have kids, they consume your resources, they take away from you. But actually what the data makes very, very clear is that married couple with children actually produce more when it comes to the economy.
They do. It's stunning. I mean, the Census Bureau has a tremendous amount of data. If people want to go to their website, they have these tables. They call them HINC tables, which just stands for household income. And they divide households by all different kinds of criteria, but it's very obvious that people who get married and have kids make more money than people who get married and don't have kids, and people who get married make more money than people who don't get married, and the longer someone stays in school, the more they're going to make money, and the longer someone keeps working until their kids leave their house, they're going to make more money. So really, what the liberals want to call a rich person in America is someone in their 50s who has teenage kids and kids in college, a husband and wife who have been working hard to raise their family and to invest in their children and in their family life. And the liberals don't want to hear that, but that is the demonstrable truth based on the data published by the government of the United States through the Census Bureau.
In those families that work, earn, raise their kids, raising the next generation of taxpayers, I might add, they are also the ones that are amassing the capital that allows the economy to grow.
Without question. There's really no doubt about it. So as the traditional family shrinks as a share of American society, which is unfortunately what the census data shows, and they are the most productive members of society, and you maintain the welfare state that we've built, the burden on that family is going to get greater. And I really do think that's the fundamental divide. And I think, when you look at the exit polls from the presidential elections, and by the way, in the latest presidential election poll in 2016, on a national basis, they did not ask people if they had kids. They did back in 2012, but they didn't in 2016. But among people who were married in 2016, they voted for Trump, not for Clinton. People who were married in 2012 voted for Romney, not for Obama. And people who were married and had kids were more likely to vote for Romney, not for Obama. And so that's the pattern. And to put it quite bluntly, if you're a liberal and you're looking for a political constituency, a married couple with kids really isn't your base. And another element of it is people who go to church regularly, they do not vote for liberal presidential candidates. So you find a family, they're a married couple, they have kids, they work hard, they go to church. That's not a liberal family.
So, Terry, Jeffrey, let's unpack this for just a moment, because we're talking a little bit about the economic aspects of this. A married couple with kids, that's where you see the highest medium income and obviously the savings that is a part of that builds the economy. Culturally and politically, this has ramifications for the future. As you just pointed out, married couples tend to vote conservative, non-married people vote more liberal. There's the broad picture. What does that mean then, if we're seeing fewer people get married and having kids?
It means that the future for conservative politics in this country is in jeopardy. And I think if we continue this demographic change where the family is disappearing, I think that conservatives getting elected to office is going to disappear. And I think this is America. This, I really do believe this is at the core of the trend. You get rid of the family, you're going to get rid of conservatism in the United States of America. And you get rid of the family, you're going to build a welfare state. And people who build a welfare state and have a political interest in a welfare state do not have a political interest in strong families. It's really that simple. And I think the Census Bureau numbers show it. So I think there really is a cultural war in the United States. We've been fighting it for a long time. But we're getting to a point where we may get beyond the point of no return, and we don't want to get there. So I think people need to stand up and fight for this. They need to fight for traditional family values. They have to make people recognize that this is really inextricably tied not only to the economic welfare of the United States, but to our freedom as individuals. We do not want to be dependent on the state. In my view, Tony, we also don't want the state teaching our kids what's right and wrong. And I think when you have broken families, there's a tendency for the state, especially through the public school system and other institutions, to move in there and become really the cultural formers, the moral formers of children and of the next generation. We don't want that. We want parents teaching their kids the values that have made Western civilization great since the beginning.
So the future of America hinges on the well-being of the family.
Yep.
All right. Terry Jeffrey, as always, a great article. You do outstanding work. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Tony.
you want to find out more about Terry Jeffrey, just head on over to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Also, a quick reminder that your generous contributions to Family Research Council enable us to continue making these programs available, and you can donate when you visit TonyPerkins.com. We'll be back with Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? Pornography fuels the sex trafficking industry. Each click of pornography creates a demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. Victims of sex trafficking are often coerced into having abortions. To learn more about how you can help stop this triple threat, go to frc.org/traffic.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. A week ago Tuesday, a 15-year-old boy opened fire on his classmates at Marshall County High School in Kentucky, killing two students and injuring several others as they waited for the morning bell to ring. 3 days after the shooting, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin offered hope to the grieving community and called on churches in the state to hold a day of prayer to remember and honor the victims and help the community heal. Governor Bevin joined Tony on Wednesday to talk about it.
Governor, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much. It's great to speak with you this evening.
Now, Governor, I was just telling the story about what happened last week in Kentucky and then your call to the citizens of Kentucky to pray, calling upon churches to pray, then, of course, the backlash, the mockers that came out. But let me ask you, how important is it, do you see prayer in healing the people that have gone through such a tragedy as this?
I've seen firsthand evidence just in Marshall County, just in the last week and change, for exactly how important it is. These people volitionally, not because they were instructed to, not because anyone came from the outside and suggested it, but organically and volitionally from within that community. They had prayer vigils, prayer meetings, gatherings of people, students and adults alike, independent of the school, at the school, in places of worship, outside places of worship. It was remarkable. And again, the reason being is not because this provides a false solace, but because it is a direct and immediate connection to the very creator that endowed us with the inalienable rights that so often we have taken for granted in this country, that our founders understood was important. And I just found it encouraging, frankly, as a person of faith myself, to see this community binding together through this in a terrifically terrible time. And yet they were coming together and comforted by their faith. And again, look out the history of our country. I mean,
right
from the very beginning, this has been something recognized by our political leaders as something of importance.
Governor, I know you're a man of faith. We've spoken. You've been one of our featured speakers at the Values Voters Summit. And, you know, there, when you've had to walk through these things as a public figure helping others deal with tragedies, as you say, this is not just some kind of empty practice, but it is real. It's tangible. You can feel it. You can see it in the wake of tragedies like this. The mocking that comes with this, in my view, that's designed to drive us away from the very thing that can help us, and all the more reason why we should not lose sight of what it is that can truly help us as a nation and as a community.
It's interesting, too, because so often people mock because they think this is sort of a public knee-jerk response when people don't know what else to do or if they're trying to put up a false front of hope or what have you. But the reason I am so convinced of the power of this is severalfold. Personally, just in my own life, I've experienced and seen the significant power of prayer. And not everybody shares my faith, and I appreciate that. And I understand that for some, they literally have no idea of what I'm speaking, and that's fair enough. But I also, in this specific instance of those in Marshall County, it wasn't just the public calls and the public vigils and the public prayer that was accomplished. I have spent hours with the parents of the two children who lost their lives. and with some of the parents of those that were injured. And these are people who also, privately, with broken hearts, have called out to God, both while I'm there, but from my understanding and in conversation with them, long before I sat down with them, and probably even in many times after that fact. The point being is that people do this individually, and they do it collectively, not to give themselves false promise. I will tell you from personal experience, having lost our oldest daughter in a tragic car accident, it is at a time like that that if it were not real, you would know it. You would not pretend as a parent who has lost a child that the solace and the comfort that comes from prayer with one's creator was fake. If you think it's fake, you're not going to pretend at a time like that that it isn't. And I will tell you, I've seen the same thing with these parents. And if people look at the history of this nation, look at the history of Western civilization, look at the history of the world, there has been time and time again. I'm reading an interesting book right now to my boys at night. Each night we read a different chapter. It's called Miracles in American History, 32 Amazing Stories of Answered Prayer. And it was ironic. I was about two-thirds of the way through this book by a woman named Susie Federer. And about two-thirds of the way through this book when this tragedy happened. And it's just, it struck me at how often America has been sustained by this communication with God.
Well, Governor, thank you for issuing that challenge, but more importantly, thank you for being an example of that in the state of Kentucky. Governor, great to talk with you again. Thanks so much for being on the program, and you and the state of Kentucky are in our prayers.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Governor Bevin when you visit tonyperkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. And if you find the weekend edition of Washington Watch informative and useful, we'd encourage you to tell your friends about Washington Watch. You can help us reach more people with this radio ministry by supporting our efforts and heading over to tonyperkins.com and clicking on the donate button. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.